12 Who Shaped San Diego, a series of radio programs on local history, biographies of 12 great men and women who have left their mark on today's San Diego.
They thought he was just off his rocker. And it wasn't until he laid out the town, surveyed it, and started selling lots, and then the railroad boom started for the Texas and Pacific Railroad. And then there was a great boom in San Diego, and Horton practically became a millionaire just in a matter of a few years. From 1867, when he came here, to 1871, it was in that period that the people realized that he had something there.
San Diego began in the area that is today Presidio Hill and Old Town. It was Alonzo Horton who was instrumental in moving the city to its present location near the harbor. By that move, and by Horton's activities in San Diego, the city was changed tremendously. The life of Alonzo Horton is the subject of this sixth program in the series, 12 Who Shaped San Diego. I'm Peter Hamlin, and joining me is San Diego historian and chief historical consultant for these programs, Dr. Claire Crane. Claire, we hinted in the last program that the next major event in San Diego's history is the moving of the city to the site that is now downtown. Of course, before that, San Diego was situated where Old Town is now, and hardly anything was going on near the harbor. I'm curious what early efforts were made to move San Diego to that location.
Well, the most important effort to move it came in 1850 as a direct result of the American conquest of California. A boundary commission was sent out to California to survey and mark the boundary between the United States and Mexico. And the chief surveyor for that was a man named Andrew Gray. And after his job was done with the boundary commission, he stayed on in San Diego because he had seen the harbor and decided that it was really a prime location for the development of a city, because he believed that a transcontinental railroad would be built out to the west coast to tie these great ports on the Pacific coast with the rest of the United States. And he saw San Diego as being a logical and prime location for a railroad connection because it was right next to the harbor. So he staked out a 160-acre piece of land, and he got, as a partner, a man named William Heath Davis, who was a merchant and a man who had, for a number of years, beginning in the 1830s, had been trading along the coast of California and had married into the Estadillo family. They talked to José Antonio Estadillo, and he encouraged them in their plans to lay out a city, which they called New Town, right about near where the police station and the old ferry landing, the development of the new development of Seaport Village and so on, in that location, right on the shores of the harbor.
In Old Town, as these various efforts were being made to move the city to a new location, was there bad feeling? Did people generally ignore the people that wanted to move the site of the city?
Oh, they thought they were crazy.
June Redding works at the Thomas Whaley House in Old Town, and she is an historian who has had a great deal to do with the saving and restoration of that house. In her view, the early developers of New Town before Horton are not really given the credit they deserve.
Davis really tried and was never actually given credit for the great effort that he made nor the money that he spent in the effort to establish New Town. Had he had any cooperation from the government, probably New Town would have done very well. It was a tremendous effort on Davis's part, and it seems to have kind of gone by the wayside historically. Davis almost went broke on that effort, and some of the problems become very, poignant when you find that Davis was forced to run back and forth because of his business interests in San Francisco. George Pendleton, who later became the county recorder and county clerk here, wrote to him repeatedly and told him that his buildings were, some of them, standing empty, that if he wanted to keep his town together, he had to get these buildings rented, and that it would be advisable for him to come back. And take care of his affairs, because even though he was taking care of his bookwork and so forth and trying to handle business for him, certain decisions he couldn't make did require Davis's person to be there. And I don't know what Davis's involvement was. It was rumored at that time when he was involved in this development that he was making over $10,000 a month, which was a sizable sum of money at that time, but apparently lost everything in his effort to keep Newtown going. And so for that reason, the town just dwindled, and it was a rather pathetic thing to find that people traveling through the area were dismantling his houses and so forth, and they were simply, lumber was so scarce and so difficult to come by that they were just simply taking the lumber and carrying it along with them and using it to build other structures as they went along.
One of the problems that the Gray and Davis Newtown development never took off is that there was not a railroad subsidy granted that would bring a railroad into San Diego. As most of us know, there was a big railroad subsidy that brought the railroad finally into San Francisco in 1869, but no money was forthcoming to subsidize this railroad, to subsidize a southern route. The other thing that certainly didn't help them any was that the final report of the United States Boundary Commission contained a comment on San Diego saying, "Without wood, water, or arable land, this place will never rise to importance."
And so Davis's Folly, as it was called, never did develop into a successful town. And what is now downtown San Diego didn't really develop until Alonzo Horton came on the scene. Horton came to San Diego relatively late in life, and interestingly enough, by the time he got here, he had already founded a town in Wisconsin, which still bears his name, Hortonville. Hortonville is a village with a population of 1,831, and it's located in the central part of Wisconsin. Interestingly enough, we have some articles that were recently written in the Hortonville paper about Alonzo Horton. It says, "Alonzo Horton also founded San Diego," in a large headline. The first line of the article is, "Ironically, the man who founded Hortonville was at least equally as famous for starting another city, San Diego." Well, to find out about that early period in Horton's life, we phoned the village of Hortonville and spoke with Shirley Vance, a longtime resident who became interested in Alonzo Horton while she was editor of the local newspaper. And while editor, she wrote several articles about him.
He was 21 when he left his home in the East and came to Milwaukee when he was 23 in 1836. And he was married in 1841 and came to Hortonville in 1848 when he was 35. He had, after his wife passed away, he had gone to St. Louis and purchased land warrants there that were given to discharged soldiers at the close of the Mexican War. And in February of 1848, he bought 1,500 acres at 70 cents per acre, or for an investment of $1,050, which included the 160 acres that Hortonville is located on.
To get that in perspective, 70 cents an acre would be a pretty good price today, I'm sure. By about what factor?
Here is running now from any of the farm property from $1,000 to $8,000 an acre.
Did he indeed buy the land and then sell it at a profit even in the relatively short time he was there?
Well, he gave away quite a bit of land to encourage settlement. But when he left, he had a profit of between $7,000 and $8,000.
It sounds like he really knew what he was doing in terms of selling real estate.
Well, I talked with Mrs. Reinders, who was the first woman on our village board, and she showed me her land deeds that Horton sold some of this property here to his father in January of 1851 for $1,400. According to what we could find, it was a quarter of a section. And in 1851, Horton's mother and father sold the property for $400. So he evidently made a profit on his parents, but probably gave away land to other people.
As we'll see later, Horton paid even less for his land in San Diego. He paid, if he paid 70 cents an acre in Hortonville, he only paid 27 cents an acre here in San Diego. Really got a big bargain.
Horton wasn't to stay long in Hortonville. He headed west, partly to seek a better climate on the advice of his doctor, but he probably had something on his mind other than founding another town.
I don't think he had any intention of taking land in California. It was the gold, I believe, that interested him the most. And from what I can understand, he left here and went to San Francisco for gold. But then that didn't pan out, and he ended up selling ice to them and made a big profit on that. He brought it in and sold it. The same, we had an ice house here in Hortonville, right on the mill pond that he had built the dam for his mill. And they sold the ice for $3 a month for the refrigerators, or $1.75 if you didn't use much, according to what I've seen.
Shirley Vance, longtime resident of Hortonville, Wisconsin, who has done some research on Alonzo Horton and has written articles on Horton for the local newspaper. Well, with the Horton in the ice business, we see once again a man who has been involved in quite a diversity of business ventures. Now, Horton's in San Francisco. What happened to him when he got there?
Well, when he first came to California, of course, it was because of the gold rush. And as she indicated, he first tried to get into the mining business and was not successful with that. But as frankly, as most of the people who were successful during the gold rush at all, got out of the mining business and into something else instead. And in Horton's case, it was merchandise and ice, as she mentioned. He left California after that, went back to Wisconsin for a number of years, and then he returned to San Francisco in 1862, and that's when he went into the furniture business. He had a fairly successful furniture business. He was certainly comfortably off and perhaps even might have been thinking of retiring. He was 54 years old when he conceived the idea of selling out his entire business and coming to San Diego.
We pick up the story of Alonzo Horton with Elizabeth McPhail, a retired San Diego attorney and lifelong San Diegan who has completed a number of local history projects, including a book called The Story of New San Diego and its founder, Alonzo E. Horton.
Horton was about in his 50s. He was in San Francisco, and one night he went to a lecture that was given in San Francisco, and the lecture told about all of the ports of California and the harbors, and he told about the wonderful harbor in San Diego. And he'd never heard particularly anything about San Diego, but he was so enthused, he came home and told his wife that he was going to sell out his business and go down to San Diego and build a town. And she said, well, where's San Diego? And so they had to get out a map and look to see where San Diego was. But within 3 days after he made this decision, he had sold his business and had taken reservation on the next boat to San Diego. And so he arrived on April 15th, 1867. When he arrived on the 15th of April, the little boat stopped down what would be at the foot of Market Street at what was the old Davis Wharf. And they had to wait for a buckboard to come from Old Town to take the passengers. I think there were just a few passengers, 6 or 8 passengers, to Old Town. And so while he was waiting, he walked up to where the courthouse would be today. And it must have been a nice, clear day, not a foggy day. And he could see the islands and what is now Coronado, and he could see all over. And when he got to Old Town, he just looked around. And he said, well, this is no place for a town. The place for a city is down by the wharf. And then he said it was really just looked to him to be a heaven on earth. And we refer to San Diego as heaven on earth. Many people do. And as far as we know, he's the first one to have referred to it as heaven on earth, because the people who had come previously to that and left had referred to it in the opposite direction. But he saw the possibilities of a city and told George Pendleton, the county clerk in Old Town, he said, well, I wouldn't give you $5 for a deed to the whole town, because it just doesn't lie right. And so then is when he inquired about buying land in the area that he was interested in. Well, first when he asked about the buying some land, why, he was told by the county clerk, Judge Pendleton, that they couldn't sell any land, the city couldn't sell any land, because they hadn't, they didn't have a legal board of trustees. Then there'd been no business, so they'd just not had any election. And so Horton said, well, get busy and call an election, because I want to buy some land. And Pendleton told him, he said, no, he says, I can't do that. It would cost too much. And Horton said, well, how much would it cost? And Pendleton said, well, at least $5. So the story is that Horton gave him $10 and told him to call an election. So they did call an election, and the trustees were elected, the ones that that he had specified that he would like after having had a chance to meet some of the people in Old Town. And the sale was on May the 10th, the following May 10th. And at that time, he bought 960 acres for $265 at 27 and a half cents an acre. And people in Old Town thought, well, this man is crazy. He must have more money than brains.
The auction at which Horton bought the land has been described in Elizabeth MacPhail's book about Alonzo Horton and Newtown. And I'll just quote from part of it. The land that he bought was in several different parcels, and the first one on which he bid contained about 200 acres, and his first bid was $100. The people around me, he said later, began to laugh when they heard it. I thought they were laughing because I had bid so little, but on inquiring what it was customary to pay for land, I was told that $20 was a good price for a piece of land if it was smooth, or about $15 if it was rough. I did not bid so much after that. I was the only bidder on all the parcels except one. On a fractional section near where Upas Street now is, Judge Hollister bid $5 over me. I told him he could have it, and then he begged me to bid again. I finally raised him 25 cents, and then he would not bid anymore. Hollister said, you can have it. I wouldn't give a mill an acre for all you have bought. That land has lain there for a million years, and nobody has built a city on it yet. To which Horton replied, yes, and it would lie there a million years longer without any city being built on it, if it depended upon you to do it.
And then from then on, why, he had to leave and go back up to San Francisco, catch the next boat, and in order to promote and get his land surveyed, and then find people up in San Francisco who'd have the money to invest.
Well, what about that? Did people, he seems to have the exact opposite view on San Diego, Newtown, and Old Town as everybody else in the city. Did people, you know, chuckle at him when he walked by and say, there goes old crazy man Horton? Did they think he was completely off his rocker, or did they think after he spent the money, well, maybe this guy has an idea?
Oh, no, it was several years before that the people in Old Town began to realize that he had something there. They thought he was just off his rocker, and it wasn't until he laid out the town, surveyed it, and started selling lots, and then the railroad boom started for the Texas and Pacific Railroad, and then there was a great boom in San Diego, and Horton practically became a millionaire just in a matter of a few years. We're talking now between 1869 and 1873. And by 1871, the county courthouse was moved to from Old Town to New Town. So just from 1867, when he came here, to 1871, it was in that period that the people realized that he had something there, and that most of the businessmen in Old Town then were moving to New Town, and then even the courthouse was moved.
Just how the courthouse was moved is something we'll take up in a moment. But one thing seems evident in the discussion of Alonzo Horton, and that is that his fortunes were closely linked with the economic ups and downs of the period. What was going on economically in San Diego at this time?
Well, San Diego's entire economic history during this period was related to hopes that a railroad would come into San Diego. from the time that San Diego became part of the United States, time that California became part of the United States and San Diego was organized as a city in 1850, that was the great hope that a railroad would be built into San Diego. And Lewis Rose, for example, and other people had formed a railroad corporation in 1854, and they hoped that a railroad would be built. Nothing happened about that, but they had set aside land, gotten the city trustees to set aside several thousand acres of land that would be available to give to any railroad that would build the San Diego. So that land was still available. And in the early 1870s, the Texas and Pacific Railroad, whose president was Tom Scott, decided that they would try to build a railroad out to the Pacific coast along a southern route and wind up in San Diego. And so city fathers, including Alonzo Horton, invited Scott to come to San Diego, invited Tom Scott, president of the railroad, to come to San Diego. And so often this particular boom that took place in the early 1870s is referred to as the Tom Scott boom, because when Scott arrived in San Diego, people thought, aha, this means that things are really going to happen. And of course he said, oh yes, we're going to start building the railroad. And he thanked the city fathers for, you know, giving him all that land. And he said, I will go off to the East Coast and to Europe to market the bonds, which will be required for the financing of the railroad. And he did so. Unfortunately, in 1873, the bottom fell out of the stock market, and the bonds were, nobody was interested in buying the bonds, and Scott then wrote to Horton and other people in San Diego and said, you know, I'm a ruined man. I cannot do anything else. Scott had overextended himself, and as a matter of fact, he died less than 10 years later, brokenhearted and bankrupt.
Well, then the Tom Scott boom really was only the result of the expectation of this railroad, which never did come through.
That's right. As Elizabeth MacPhail mentioned, Horton became a very wealthy man simply on that expectation, because people invested in his property, bought land from him, and invested in the city of San Diego, building buildings and, you know, bringing in businesses, and this promoted the whole economy.
I would like to back up some years now and take a look at what's been going on from the point of view of the people in Old Town. Now, remember, the Old Town and Presidio Hill area had been the center of activity in this area for quite some time, and a man from San Francisco came down, bought a stretch of land, essentially barren, thought of by most of the townspeople, that is, in Old Town, to be worthless. And at this time, the late 1860s, things weren't going all that badly in Old Town. Thomas Whaley, for one, was prospering in business. The county courthouse was in Whaley's home, and that, too, was a center of activity there. In that restored courthouse, we again speak with June Redding.
They hadn't paid, I don't believe, too much attention to Alonzo Horton. Business went on as usual. But you have to remember that by the time Alonzo Horton came, Old Town was getting into a pretty thriving condition, and there was considerable business being done at the county seat. Alonzo Horton didn't arrive here until 1867, mind you. Now, Thomas Whaley had been in business here since 1851, so he was here a good 16 years before Alonzo Horton arrived. And they had gone through the hardship, the settling part, with the Indian uprising and the transfer of all the lands and so forth, and they had had their skirmishes, and things were beginning to settle down, and Old Town was taking on the semblance of a pretty good, sizable town with many businesses located on the plaza. The greater portion of business, the flow of traffic coming into town, was directed towards the county seat. Alonzo Horton determined that the only way his town would get on a firm footing and that a flow of traffic would be established was to have this county seat transferred. That was uppermost in his mind. And he had evidently watched the activity in Old Town enough so that he knew that this is where the bulk of the business was.
Well, what was going on in between Old Town and New Town in the debate, let's say, to put it politely, between where the court record should be?
Well, there was a big political struggle going on, and there were the Board of Supervisors was at one point elected, replaced by a different Board of Supervisors. There were appeals to local courts and then appeals to higher courts. Ultimately, the decision was made by the California Supreme Court, which did uphold the decision of a legally elected Board of Supervisors that the court record should be moved to their location in a new courthouse setting in Newtown. But this was a struggle that went on for about a year.
What was the reaction in Old Town when that court ruling came, was issued?
Well, when the final ruling was issued, of course, they had to give in. But prior to the final ruling, they thought that they might win out. And Thomas Whaley, of course, was very disturbed that the court was going to be moved away from his building, that he would lose a good tenant and a lot of business. And so at one point, when they were hoping for another decision, actually, there were armed guards set up in front of the courthouse in an effort to prevent the removal of the records to Newtown. But ultimately, they did have to give in because of the legal decision.
It was like an armed camp, Old Town was, and steps were taken to prevent the theft of the county records. Well, Mr. Whaley evidently thought that the town was well protected because he went about his business in the usual manner. It was also about the time for him to go north and buy supplies for his general store. And so he took the boat on a 5-day trip to San Francisco, and it was in at the period of time when he was absent from San Diego on a shopping trip that the county records were seized from the Whaley house. March 31st, 1871, evidently, probably not wanting to make an entry in the daytime, and this was another thing that always caused us to wonder why the threat was not carried out in the daytime. It was not. So the seizure was took place at night, and March 31st, 1871, at midnight, men came into Old Town in Wells Fargo wagons with drivers and teams that were rented also from the company. And two wagons pulled into Old Town came into... They actually muffled the horses' hoofs with burlap sacks, greased the axles of the wheels heavily so that the noise of the wheels turning wouldn't be heard at night. They waited until midnight and evidently came down San Diego Avenue, turned into the carriage entrance, came around to the back of the building of the Whaley House. They alighted there. Some stood guard, and the others broke into the courtroom doors. At midnight, as you can imagine, everyone in town would be sleeping peacefully. Lighting was not good here, and so people wouldn't be aware that anyone would be abroad at this time of night. So they succeeded in gathering up most of the material and some of the furniture, and then realized that the rest of the records that they were seeking were in the second floor of this house. That made it necessary for them to come through the house and down the hall. And by the time they had gathered up everything they thought necessary here, they began to ascend the stairs and met Mrs. Whaley, who, apparently awakened by the sound of the men's voices, had dressed hastily and had come down to confront them. Anna Whaley, in the darkness of the night, thought first probably of her children, thought of her husband being away, and wondered who it was that would enter this house in such a manner and seize the records. And so she decided, brave woman that she was, decided to face them and see for herself. She began descending the stairs as they rose up, and on the ninth step met the men face to face, and it was at this point that they threatened her at gunpoint, told her to stand aside, or told her that if she didn't let them pass, they wouldn't be accountable for what would happen. And so Anna let the men pass up the stairs, and powerless, she couldn't do much about it. She didn't want her children threatened. She didn't know exactly what they intended to do. And that night, the records, the minute books of the Board of Supervisors, were taken from the upper rooms and removed to Newtown. Then the irate townspeople, of course, the next morning was April 1st, and they realized that a horrible April Fool's joke had been perpetrated on the community and that this spelled death for Old Town. Old Town was not going to be the thriving town that it had been formerly at all. The whole thing came to them. And there was some talk of forming a posse and going over and shooting up Newtown and taking the records. In the meantime, the records were stored in the second floor of the Wells Fargo building.
June Redding with the Whaley House in Old Town.